try the following. Make it clear you don't have the information. Just tell them, I don't know. Deflect the question by asking one yourself. I don't know. Why do you ask? Give a vague, generic answer that doesn't actually reveal any information. Refer them to a public source. I think that's on our website. Change the topic immediately. Spy encounters. Alex. Getting jacked up by foreign police. Getting stopped by foreign police can really mess up an operation, so I always had to be very careful about how I behaved whenever that happened. I spent many years working in Asia, and I've gotten stopped by the police in Seoul and Tokyo. I always knew that the number one way to mess up would be to carry a gun. You just can't do that, especially in Japan. It completely goes against their culture, and if caught, you could land in jail for a very long time. I learned that the best way to deal with the foreign police was to act polite, answer their questions quickly, but not to act like I was in a big hurry. That made them suspicious of my motives. I was always sure to speak English, even though my Japanese is very good. I wanted it to be clear that I was from a foreign country, and it's less likely that they would mess with an American. Usually, they'd be satisfied with my answers, and they'd let me go on my way. One time, I was casing out a quiet residential neighborhood in Japan when the police stopped me. They started questioning me very heavily, and I got the feeling they were not going to let me go so easily. I was starting to get nervous because it would really mess things up for me if they decided to take me in. I'm not proud of it, but I started answering their questions in a manner that may have suggested I was an afflicted person. I just acted confused and smiled a lot and nodded my head. I honestly wanted them to think I was not very bright or not all there. It worked. The police came to the conclusion that I was harmless and they left me alone. Chapter 6. Snatching and grabbing a narco-terrorist. How to survive a kidnapping. The requirement. Confirm the true identity of an individual believed to be a lead figure in a drug ring. This individual is traveling into the United States using the identity of a New York, U.S. citizen. Once identity is confirmed, this individual will be subject to extraordinary rendition, removed from his native country, and brought to undisclosed location. Participants. Case Officer Trevor McDonnell, hereafter referred to as alias Chad. Case Officer Robert Darby, hereafter referred to as alias Ethan. Case Officer Linda Patterson, hereafter referred to as alias Anna. Target, Mateo Sanchez, hereafter referred to as alias Windsor. Trading your life for paradise. Imagine the following scenario. Someone approaches you and asks if you'd like to live in the Bahamas. That sounds pretty good to you, but then the offer gets better. The house is paid for, it won't cost you anything, and they'll give you a couple of $1 million too. Sounds great, right? But there's more. In exchange for a house in paradise and a large sum of cash, you'll have to give something in return. Your identity. They'll want your birth certificate, driver's license, passport, social security number, and bank information. Actually, they want to get down to the essence of who you really are, so they'll take your computer too. You just need to stop being you and say goodbye to your friends and community. Now that you know the real story, you don't want to do it. That's when they say, "Oh well, I hope your kids will be okay walking home from school every day." Terrified for their lives, you realize you don't have much choice. The person you hand everything over to is likely associated with a serious criminal. You hope your kids will be safe in your new life, and your old life? Your identity is now being assumed by a major narcotics dealer. He's become you. He'll use your social security number and bank account, and having your passport means he can travel freely between his native country and the United States whenever he wants. Collapsing the chain. Date, time, and place of contact. January 21st, Residential Street, Bogota, Colombia. Name, Windsor. Age, 39. Height, 5'8". Weight, 175 pounds. Hair, black with streaks of gray, long in back, thinning. Glasses, no. Personality, demeanor, attributes. Highly intelligent, cunning, can win over people when necessary, known to be brutal. Nationality, citizenship. Colombian, Colombia. Known languages, Spanish, English. Family. Parents deceased, brother aged 38, brother aged 35. Girlfriend. One aged 26, another aged 32. Address, Bogota, Colombia, also New York, New York. Chad recalls, it might sound hard to believe, but it's true that criminals from other nations are willing to pay large sums of money for an American identity to continue their work as the most brutal and violent drug dealers in the world. We call them narco-terrorists. These guys are the worst of the worst. Some narco-terrorists are so sadistic, they treat the people working for them like animals. These people will be working in the crops or factories completely naked, so there's no chance they can escape or steal. The ability to travel freely between America and the native country where the rest of the drug ring is located means this narco-terrorist is transporting drugs and money into the United States and killing lots of people in the process. It was my job to lead a team that stops this from happening, and we were after Windsor, who we believed to be the top narco-terrorist in the drug chain. Our ultimate goal was to break the chain. That means we're clamping down on the entire operation from end to end to stop it for once and for all. We need to know where the drugs were being grown and all the players involved. Part of the team would map out where the drugs were going. Other parts would figure out who was driving the trucks and who the lowlifes were who sold the drugs outside of schools. If we didn't collapse the entire chain from end to end and just went after a few key individuals, a new person would just pop up to replace the guy we took out. That doesn't solve the problem, because in the world of drug dealing, there's always another Windsor. Think like a spy. Always examine the bigger picture. While it seems that taking out a major drug dealer like Windsor will solve a big problem, like illegal drugs being brought over our borders into America, it's only one part of the story. Because these guys have worked hard to figure out the big picture, they know the problem won't be solved for good until other elements of the situation are also dealt with. While it's often tempting to focus on one problem, make sure you are looking closely at the entire situation to determine if there are larger issues that also need to be conquered. What other challenges might arise? Who else is involved? What actions need to be taken to solve the problem for once and for all? Chad continues. So while the big goal was to break down the entire chain, my specific job was to work with others to take out the bad guy. In this case, that was Windsor, who was easily flying in and out of the United States on an illegally purchased passport. This part of the process is called extraordinary rendition, and it's dangerous and difficult. This is because the end result is kidnapping our target and getting him out of the United States for good. It's also politically challenging. No foreign country likes their citizens being snatched up by the United States, especially when it happens on their turf. That's why we spend months, if not years, being incredibly careful and collecting lots of information. We have to be sure we're focused on the right person and there is no room for mistakes. Making sure and making sure again before we go in. Date, time, and place of contact. March 17th, 8:04 p.m., classified restaurant, Bogota, Colombia. Chad continues. A drug bust is something TV and movies get completely wrong. In the movies, the good guys swoop in and grab the bad guy. It all happens in a few minutes, and you get little or none of the backstory. The truth is, to pull off something this complicated and delicate, it takes years of training and the expertise of many different people. We just can't risk grabbing the wrong guy, or worse, a completely innocent person. These operations require the expertise of several different entities. It could be the Border Patrol, the CIA, and the NSA, all exchanging information, putting together our different pieces like a big puzzle. We'll have drones collecting data, we'll be eavesdropping, checking his phone, and we'll be taking pictures. After we've gathered all the biographical data, we have to actually collect fingerprints and sometimes DNA. Just getting a simple set of fingerprints takes more planning and work than you might imagine. Because we had been following Windsor and watching him for a long time, we knew that he occasionally went to a restaurant in one of the rougher neighborhoods in Bogota. Windsor was no dummy, and remember, he had his own team of people whose job it was to protect him. This meant he had enough sense not to have any regular patterns of behavior. He wasn't going to just show up at the same restaurant at the same time every Tuesday night. He was careful, and that made our job harder. Ethan, one of my teammates, had been making the rounds, getting to know people in the area, and hanging out at local establishments. That's how we knew there was a chance that eventually Windsor could turn up at a few different places, including the restaurant we were hoping to catch him at. We had people watching the different places where Windsor might show up and waited patiently for an opportunity to jump into action. One Friday night, I was at home eating dinner when the phone rang. It was Ethan calling to say that Windsor's car had just pulled up to the specific restaurant. This might be the chance we'd been waiting for. I was out the door in seconds and picked up our teammate Anna along the way. When I got to Anna's place, she took over the driving because I couldn't be seen. I'm a big guy, but I stayed low so it wouldn't look like I was even in the car. The plan was for Anna to enter the restaurant and order a drink, watching Windsor the entire time. If she saw that Windsor was busy and engaged and unlikely to walk out to his car any minute, then Anna would step outside and light up a cigarette. That was my signal to move in and get the prints. Anna parked in a dark part of the parking lot and went inside the restaurant. I hid behind the car, scanning the area to see if anyone was watching me. About 10 minutes later, Anna came out and lit up. We were good to go. Moving as quietly and quickly as possible, I snuck up to Windsor's car and affixed some clear, nearly invisible tape right about where Windsor's hand would touch it to open the door. This would give us a set of fingerprints so we could get a positive ID before we took the big step of snatching him. I had one more thing to do. I affixed a small piece of electrical tape to the left taillight to help our people keep track of Windsor's car. Then I quickly and carefully made my way back to our car and prepared to wait for Anna. Anna came out after finishing her drink and we left. We were glad it went well so far. We wouldn't know if we got a good print until Ethan retrieved the tape, and that would be an entirely different challenge. Think like a spy. Collect all the information you can. It would be a complete disaster to grab the wrong guy. There's just no room for error when pulling off an extraordinary rendition. It's not enough to spy on someone's phone calls or even get their fingerprints. All the data must be examined and collected before a positive identification is made. It's tempting to look to one source of information when trying to make a big decision, but you always want to collect as much information as you can from multiple sources to make the most informed decision possible. Date, time, and place of contact. March 17th, 11:20 p.m., the intersection of two streets, El Bronx, Bogota, Colombia. Chad continues. Ethan needed to retrieve the tape, but he needed to do it without anyone noticing. That meant Ethan was in position, watching every move Windsor made. It was easier now to follow his car, since Ethan could identify it by the marking on the taillight. As soon as his car stopped and Windsor got out, Ethan would have to be ready to grab the tape, and hopefully fingerprints, without being seen. If he got caught, things were going to get very messy. Ethan had his fingers crossed that Windsor wasn't headed home for the night. Security at his home was tight. But instead, that he planned to make another stop, providing an opportunity to retrieve the tape. After driving a few more blocks, Windsor parked his car. Luck was on Ethan's side. Windsor was headed into a nightclub. Once Ethan saw Windsor go inside and could ascertain that he wasn't being watched, he approached Windsor's car and took the tape. So far, the operation was a big success. Date, time, and place of contact. March 24th, 9:30 p.m., classified restaurant, Bogota, Colombia. Heating up the area. Chad continues. Anna, Ethan, and I were thrilled when the news came back that the fingerprints Ethan retrieved matched what our people had on file. But the bottom line was that fingerprints weren't enough. We needed DNA to positively confirm Windsor's identity. Ethan had been making relationships around town and was doing a great job connecting with different people. It was time for Ethan to use one of those relationships he built to help get the DNA. This was something we'd only want to do if we knew we were getting really close. You've got to be careful not to heat up the area too much when working an op. While we need to spend lots of time watching people and collecting information, things heat up when our people start asking questions. Ethan had been cultivating a relationship with one of the waitresses. He chatted with her and knew she was struggling to care for a young child by herself, and that told him money was an issue. As far as he knew, she did not have a relationship with Windsor or any of his associates. But if he started asking too many questions or making weird requests, she might get spooked or suspicious. That's why we were extra careful about getting this last but crucial bit of evidence. The next time Ethan saw Windsor at the classified restaurant, he knew it was time to ask the waitress for help. Windsor had been eating and drinking with his associates for a few hours when they all got up to leave. As the waitress was about to clear the table, Ethan called her over. Ethan simply told the waitress that he had an easy way for her to earn some money. All she had to do was give him a plate, the one Windsor had eaten off of. If she found the request strange, she didn't care once Ethan offered her $100. Once he had the plate, Ethan got it to our guys ASAP. They were going to try to get DNA off of any saliva left behind. Once we had that, we'd know for sure if we had a match. The snatch and grab. Date, time, and place of contact. April 4th, 9 o'clock a.m., Residential Street, Bogota, Colombia. Chad continues. The snatching and grabbing of our target was an intense experience, and my heart was always pounding hard in my chest as we were working up to it. We just wanted to get out of the operation in one piece, but we knew Windsor's people wanted to hurt us too. And they were all around us. We had been working hard for a long time, we had a plan ready, and everyone on the team understood what his role was. Ethan had information that Windsor was going to be headed to a meeting at approximately 9 a.m. Early that morning, our people were monitoring every move he made. Once he headed out, our people started following him. Even though we took back roads, obviously making sure he wasn't being followed, we were able to keep tabs on him without him knowing he was being watched. Our intelligence indicated that the meeting would take place at a certain street, and Ethan, Anna, and I would be there waiting with the rest of the team. The distraction that got us Windsor. We knew that a guy like Windsor wasn't going to head out to a business meeting without his security people. They were going to be armed, and they'd have no problem killing anyone who posed a threat. Obviously, this made it difficult for us to get close enough to Windsor to actually grab him. This is why we sometimes have to create a big distraction. We had to engineer a situation that would cause enough of a commotion that Windsor's people would put their guard down long enough for us to get him. Our plan was to use a staged car crash. They are so loud, it sounds like a gun being shot, and it works great. It would be environmentally appropriate, too, since we wanted to get Windsor while he was on the street. If Windsor was in a meeting on the 8th floor of a hotel, then obviously that wouldn't work. A car crash was also an event that would reasonably occur in the area. That's important, too. As our guys on the ground confirmed that Windsor was getting closer to the location, we got ready to create the distraction. Car A was parked near the building we expected Windsor to enter. Car B was held farther up the street, ready to head directly into the action when signaled. There were so many things going on. Communications flying between officers, drones flying above, a van full of CIA officers ready to jump out and grab Windsor, and all of us hoping that cars A and B would be able to connect at just the right time. As Windsor's car slowed, Car B was cued to start speeding up toward Car A. Because of some other cars on the street, he had to wait a bit before he headed over toward Car A. The path opened up, Car B picked up speed, and Car A was instructed to pull out just as Car B was flying down the road. It couldn't have gone any better. The crash sound was spectacular, very loud and sounded much worse than it actually was. And it did just what we needed it to do. As Windsor security people braced themselves for an attack from the left, the crash sounded like possible gunfire, our people immediately moved in from the right. It was crazy and chaotic, but everyone knew what to do. One of our men grabbed Windsor, bagged him, shoved him into a van, and drove him off to an airfield where a private plane was waiting. It was a successful operation, and it felt great knowing that our hard work as a team was going to keep drugs off of America's streets. Surprise, speed, and violence of action. None of our homework would matter in the end if we didn't react appropriately when the time came to nab Windsor. The standard operating procedure is surprise, speed, and violence of action. Following this procedure is crucial to completing our job. Surprise. This isn't as simple as it sounds. It's not just about running in on our target when they least expect it, although that's part of it. The main idea here is to finish all of our actions before Windsor's people are able to react. This means we're using stealth movements to get as close to our target as possible. This is also important because it means my team is being put in a good position to defend itself once the other guys realize what's happening. Speed. Obviously, we're going to move swiftly. But speed in this case also refers to moving in before the other guys know what's really happening and can attack us back. They might have a plan up their sleeves that they could execute to our detriment. For instance, maybe they have a grenade or a bomb. We have to launch our attack before they can react by launching a counterattack. Violence of action. Violence of action means to use all strength, speed, surprise, and aggression to fight your enemy. When we're going in to get someone, we are putting our lives on the line. We have to go in full force to increase our chances of getting Windsor. This means really going at it with everything we've got. Our survival depends on it. Grabbing someone like Windsor is an incredibly intense experience, and anything can happen. When it's gone right, it ends up with our getting a bag over his head and loading him onto a plane. This plane isn't your typical plane either. There's no flight plan, and we're purposely flying below the radar and taking off from a private airfield. We're going to take him somewhere, either Guantanamo Bay or one of the safe facilities the United States has in host countries all around the world. And once we've got him there, we know the world is just a little bit safer for Americans and their families. Your inner spy. Extraordinary Rendition is about our government snatching some of the worst criminals out there to keep America safe. While Extraordinary Rendition might be unusual, I'm sad to say that kidnapping is a real concern even for regular people. Many executives and high net worth individuals take my training classes because they know there's a chance they could be kidnapped, and if it ever happens, they want to survive. Unfortunately, in certain parts of the world, kidnapping is a real danger, regardless of who you are. Americans especially run the risk of being kidnapped in Mexico, where the kidnapping rate is very high, Haiti, Brazil, the Philippines, India, Colombia, and Venezuela. But kidnapping can hit close to home too. Americans watched the news in horror as the story broke about the abduction of 34-year-old mother of two, Sherry Papini. Details are still emerging, but Papini was abducted by two women while jogging and suffered horrific beatings and abuse for nearly 3 weeks. Her abductors threw her 87-pound body on the side of a California highway, and she was eventually able to flag down a motorist. She had a chain around her waist, she was badly beaten, bruised, branded, and covered in scabs. Her kidnappers had also chopped off her long blonde hair. So what do you do if the unthinkable happens? Maybe you're on vacation when you get pulled over by what you thought were the police, but now there's a gun in your face and you're being screamed at in another language and forced into a van. Or maybe you are using the ATM late at night when you're grabbed from behind. The guy who grabbed you has a weapon out and is trying to get you into a van or truck. You realize you're about to be kidnapped and you're terrified. While I hope this is something that never happens to you, know that if you are ever the victim of a kidnapping, there are some things you can do to increase your chances of being found alive. Tactic number one. Weigh your options in mere seconds. The actual abduction is one of the two most dangerous phases in the kidnapping process. If you survive the abduction, the rescue will be the other part of the process where you are also at high risk of being killed. This is because the situation is chaotic. Your kidnappers are prepared to use their weapons, and if things don't go their way, there's a chance they will simply kill you. After all, a dead body doesn't fight back. I've said this before. If someone gets you into a vehicle against your will, there's a good chance that you'll be killed. There will only be seconds to assess the situation. How many people are there? Do they have guns? Is anyone else around who can help? Can you run to safety? If you really believe you can fight off your kidnappers and escape, you should. However, if you don't believe the opportunity to run exists, and fighting them off isn't an option, your best chance for survival is to pay very close attention to what I'm going to teach you in this chapter. Whatever choice you make, you should make as big a commotion as possible before you're put in the transport vehicle. Yell, scream for help, fight, kick, anything that will draw attention to what's happening and make it as obvious as possible that you're being taken. Why staying calm matters. Obviously, if you are being kidnapped, you're going to be out of your mind with fear, and staying calm may seem like the last thing you can do. But there are a few reasons why it's critical that you try to remain calm during a kidnapping. In a state of panic, your fight-or-flight emotions take over, making it difficult to think clearly or react appropriately. If you panic, you might not pick up on opportunities to escape. And if you are taken, try to turn your focus from your fear to observing as many details as you can about who has abducted you and where they are taking you. Know that focusing on picking up details will also keep your mind engaged and you'll be less likely to panic. Know the two kinds of kidnapping. High value target. There are two kinds of kidnapping. In the first kind, you're a high value target and your kidnappers believe they will receive a large ransom for your return. You might be a high-profile CEO of a big corporation, a high-net-worth individual, or you may be related to a high-net-worth individual. If this is the case, chances are that, while they may injure you, ultimately they want to keep you alive. In situations like these, your kidnappers are likely organized, professional, and have planned out your kidnapping in advance. Quick access to money or other goods. In the other kind of kidnapping, you are being snatched solely for access to your bank account or car. It might be an express kidnapping where the people who have taken you will have you drain the money in your bank account until it's empty, or they'll demand a ransom from your family. These guys might be lifelong petty criminals or common junkies. They just want your money, and unfortunately, there's a chance they're prepared to kill you for it. If you're unable to avoid being taken away by such people, you'll have to proceed very carefully. Tactic number two, participate in your own rescue. Collect as many details as you can. While you might have just put up the fight of your life, you need to behave in a submissive manner once it's clear you're going to be taken. You don't want to fight at this point and risk further injury. Put your head down and don't look them in the eye. You want to give the idea that you're going to be a good hostage, quiet and compliant. You want your kidnappers to think you'll do whatever is asked of you. Meanwhile, you need to pay close attention to what's going on. Note as many of the following details as possible. How are your kidnappers dressed, if you're not blindfolded? How many voices are you hearing? What language are they speaking? Do you detect any accents? Are any names being used? Repeated phrases? In the transport vehicle, if you can, try to visualize the route being taken. How many turns? Can you hear street noise? How fast are you going? Are you on a highway or a city street? How long do you think you've been in the vehicle? In the holding spot or safe house, you may be taken to several places. Once you are brought inside a location, you should notice as much as you can about your surroundings and what's happening there. Do you hear any sounds from the street? Are there any noises in the building? Can you hear if others are being held? Do you smell anything? If there are no windows, use the change in temperature to determine differences between night and day. What kind of schedule do your captors keep? Are people coming and going at certain times? Are they eating or sleeping at different times of day? You are in one of the most stressful situations imaginable. Try to remember that by collecting details, you are participating in your own rescue. Also know that the longer you're held captive, the greater the chance you'll get out alive. Leave a DNA trail. What most Americans don't know is that you can start leaving a DNA trail that could help authorities find you. It doesn't sound pretty, but leaving behind a trail of spit, blood, or even vomit can allow authorities to retrace your steps. The DNA can also be used to positively ID that you are in fact the victim, and sometimes it also creates a timestamp for where you were at a specific time in your capture. Try biting your tongue until it bleeds and then spitting or pulling out a clump of your hair. Don't make it obvious that you're doing this on purpose. Spit while coughing or crying. If at all possible, leave DNA in each place the attackers take you, including at the scene of the abduction and in any transport vehicles. Leaving DNA in safe houses, what you need to know first. Once you are taken to a safe house, you'll want to continue to leave a trail of DNA. But most kidnappers are smart enough to wash down surfaces to hide any traces that you've been there. So how do you continue leaving a trail of DNA? In order to leave behind DNA that won't be removed by your kidnappers, two things must happen. Number one, have a conversation about kidnapping survival. You need to discuss this tactic with your loved ones. You need to share what you've learned about leaving DNA behind in the event of a kidnapping. Should your family ever have any reason to believe that you've been kidnapped, they should inform the police and also tell them you've been trained in kidnapping survival tactics. This lets the police know that when they find a location where you have been taken, they can look for your DNA in unusual places. This also puts you as a victim in a higher position. You're not a helpless victim, but a trained individual leaving clues to help the authorities find you. Number two, leave DNA in unusual places. You want to keep leaving DNA, but any spit or blood you leave in a safe house is going to be wiped away by your kidnappers. However, they aren't going to clean areas such as under tables, behind furniture, or under rugs. It sounds crazy, but these are the ideal places for you to continue your DNA trail. Leave your hair, fingerprints, or even better, bloody fingerprints. And because your family has informed the authorities that you're trained in kidnapping survival tactics, they'll know to search in these places for traces that you've been there. Build a rapport. If you hear the kidnappers talking about being Muslim, appeal to their religious side by explaining that you believe in God too. Family is a topic that most people have feelings about, so talk about your kids, or about being a brother or sister. You may be able to connect about mundane topics, such as hobbies or even sports. The goal is for your kidnapper to view you as a human being, and not an object. Talking with your kidnappers can also help reveal some important information that may help you survive. Good behavior may create complacency. One of the reasons you need to behave in a submissive manner is so that they don't see you as a security risk. If you're yelling and screaming, they might tape your mouth shut. If you're fighting, they might tie you up or chain you to something. If you do exactly what is asked of you, it's possible they'll become complacent and they may trust you to stay put and will leave you alone. This means they might not even lock the door of the room you're in. This may present an opportunity to escape. Identify the weak link. Not everyone in a group has the same mindset. There is likely a leader giving orders and someone who feels bad about what they are doing to you. You need to determine which kidnapper is the most sensitive. There are several ways to do this. You can try to see if one of the kidnappers will agree to tell your family that you're okay. Or you can look one in the eye, one time, and say, I'm in a lot of pain from that fall when you guys took me. Would you get me some Tylenol? And see if he does. If someone apologizes to you after you've been kicked or pushed, that might be your guy. Also, pay attention if anyone seems to be checking on you more often to see that you're okay, or brings you a little bit more food. This is the person who may end up assisting you during the rescue phase. This person might end up helping you physically escape the place you're being held. He might show you how to get to an exit or help you if you're hurt. Try to exploit this person's sensitive side. Try to appeal to him on any level you can. Be grateful for whatever he brings you. Remember, your goal is to let him see that you are a human being. Favorite spy trick: busting free when duct taped to a chair. As I mentioned in Spy Secrets That Can Save Your Life, breaking out of duct tape is surprisingly easy to do, and it's the most common way a criminal is going to bind your hands, since duct tape is common and cheap. It's also surprisingly easy to escape if you're duct taped to a chair. All you need to do is lean back as far as you possibly can, and, in one swift and fluid motion, move your head towards your knees, as if you were assuming the crash position in an airplane. It's possible that you'll have to repeat the movement more than one time before the tape breaks, but it's entirely possible to do. Tactic number 3: survive the rescue operation. While you'll obviously want nothing more than to be rescued, you need to know that a rescue operation is highly dangerous. A rescue is usually attempted only once negotiations for ransom have failed. Rescues are as chaotic as, or perhaps more so than, actual abductions, and you are at risk of being mistaken for one of the kidnappers or shot by a stray bullet. Establish a health problem. You can actually plant the seeds for a safer rescue early on in your captivity. Remember that Tylenol I told you to ask for? That's a perfect opportunity to establish a health problem that might end up saving your life. Let your kidnapper know that you think you sustained an injury. Tell them you have a persistent pain in your abdomen, for example. You can say that you really think something was hurt when they kicked you. Persistently develop this problem during your captivity. It's important, though, that you don't go into too much detail or make up a health problem that is hard to prove you really have. If you tell them you're diabetic and need insulin, it will be very obvious you're lying when you don't go into a diabetic coma. The actual rescue. What most Americans don't know is that the rescue team will set off a series of environmentally appropriate sounds. A car horn, machinery clanking, a dog barking, or even a rooster crowing. Animal sounds would be pre-recorded if you are held in a rural area. That series of sounds, whether it's 3 consecutive sounds or maybe 2 short sounds followed by a long one, alerts the rescue team that it's time to break into the facility from all entry points. Obviously, there's no way for you to know what kind of sounds your rescue team will use as a signal before they break entry. However, as a hostage, you can make it a point to listen to what kinds of sounds you hear in the environment you're being held in. You may be able to determine what kinds of sounds would be used and be on alert for them. When the entry is breached and the rescuers come in, your fake injury comes into play immediately. You want to use that injury to have a reason to double over, throwing your body onto the floor on your back. This is the safest position for you to be in. On your back with your hands and legs open and visible. This way the rescue team can see you're not holding a gun or another weapon. It's crucial that you stay down because your rescuers are going to be ready to shoot at any movement that happens above waist height. If all goes as planned, you will be removed from the facility and receive any medical care you require. When you are able to speak and think clearly, the police or FBI will interview you. All of the details you noted during your abduction will be collected, helping you to put your kidnappers away for a very long time. Author's note: to learn the crucial tactics that can help make sure you and your loved ones don't become the victims of a kidnapping, check out our flagship Spy Escape and Evasion course at www.spysafety.com. Spy Encounters. Linus, Searching for Legal Travelers. The truth is, we sometimes want legal travelers as much as narco-terrorists do, but for completely different reasons. A legal traveler, for our purposes, is someone who can travel from a country that we can easily operate in to a hostile foreign country that we can't easily get into. A legal traveler would be able to enter hostile territory, collect secrets, and bring them back to us on more friendly turf. I found my best legal traveler completely by chance. I was working in Paris and was casing out the city. I decided to get something to eat and went into a Middle Eastern restaurant. The restaurant was fairly empty. I took a table with a view of the door and sat down and ordered my food. While I was waiting, an attractive young woman walked by. She was wearing exercise clothes and had an air of confidence about her. She stopped by and introduced herself as Greta. She walked into the kitchen and actually came back with my food. It turns out that she owned the place. We chatted for a while and I told her about my business. My cover that time was travel agent. She told me about her restaurant and how she loved serving food from her native Iran. I couldn't believe my luck and I basically told her so. The only difference was that I told her I needed to establish how safe it was for my clients to travel to Iran, and I'd love to hear more from her on that topic. We made a dinner date for the following night when her restaurant was closed. We had a lovely meal, and I was able to see right away that this woman had access. She casually told me stories of different activities her brothers and uncles were involved in back home, and I could see that this information could be very valuable. I had her checked out, and everything she said was true. I was able to develop her fairly quickly, and it wasn't long before she was bringing me back intelligence from Iran. She traveled there several times a year, and each time, she brought me valuable information. I found throughout my career that legal travelers are one of the best tools a case officer can have. I was always grateful to Greta and the work she did for our country. Chapter 7. Protecting the greatest minds in the world from hostile foreign countries. How to travel safely when others want to harm you. The requirement. Locate asset in the host country and protect individual from possible threats from other hostile countries. Determine if individual is open to working directly with the U.S. government. Obtain information on subject's work, which is still classified to this day. Participants. Case officer Alvin Henry, hereafter referred to as alias Oscar. Hugo Thomas, hereafter referred to as alias Ezra. Elias Horvath, hereafter referred to as alias Isaac. A different kind of asset. Oscar recalls, "I've seen just about everything. I've had moments when I've been absolutely terrified and I've thought to myself, I never want to do this kind of work again. I would go home to my family and try to convince myself I should stay put. But then I'd get a call about a requirement and I'd be right back at it. There have also been moments when I couldn't believe how blessed I was to do intelligence work. One of the times when I felt really fortunate was when I was protecting national assets. Asset in this case means something different from what you're probably thinking. The kinds of assets I was protecting weren't property or goods, and they weren't military assets like submarines or planes. I was protecting individuals who were so brilliant, their minds so advanced, that they needed the protection of the U.S. government. These people were usually mathematicians or physicists, some of the biggest brains in the entire world. In many cases, they had developed something or were capable of developing something that was so valuable that many countries would want it. That meant the asset was in constant danger of being kidnapped by a hostile foreign country. It was my job to make sure that didn't happen. Is he legit? The first time I worked with a national asset, I nearly made a big mess of the entire thing. The United States wanted to know if Mathematician X was the real deal. While I'm trained in many areas, there was just no way I could verify if someone was an extraordinary math genius worthy of high-level government protection. That's out of my league. It takes one national asset to verify the qualifications of another. Very few people are smart enough to do it. So I was set up to escort Mathematician Y, who was a national asset himself, to meet mathematician X. Y was going to determine if X was as brilliant as everyone thought. My job was to protect mathematician Y, but also to pay attention to the meeting. I might not have understood all the talk about mathematical formulas, but we don't really want one national asset talking to another potential asset without some supervision. All I really had to do was get mathematician Y to the meeting place. But mathematician Y is so valued that he doesn't actually go out in public very often. Putting these two guys together someplace where they could be spotted was too dangerous. The plan was to fly mathematician Y on a private plane that would land in the middle of an empty field. Then I'd escort Y over to X. That seemed simple enough. We landed and had a very short window of time for this meeting to happen. My orders were to have mathematician Y back in the air quickly. We started walking to the meeting, but were stopped by a significant obstacle. There was a big fence right in the middle of the field, blocking the place we needed to get to. I was getting really nervous. I had one job to do, and this could mess it all up. The minutes were ticking. I walked up to the fence, pulled on a post, and much to my surprise, I was able to lift it right out of the ground. Y looked at me like I was Hercules. He just couldn't believe it. I didn't tell him the fence was loose. We took our meeting and were back up in the air soon enough. Looking back, that case was a cinch compared to my others. Spy versus spy. Date, time, and place of contact. École Polytechnique, Paris, France. Name, Isaac. Age, 47. Height, 5'9". Weight, 186 pounds. Hair, blonde, long. Glasses, yes. Personality, demeanor, attributes. Withdrawn, quiet, shy, socially awkward. Has developed Formula X, determined to be a valuable contribution to mathematics. Nationality, citizenship. Both classified to this day. Known languages. Hungarian, English, Romanian, German. Family. Wife, age 45. Daughter, age 16. Daughter, age 14. Son, age 12. Address, residential apartment, Paris, France. Everyone wanted Isaac. He was brilliant and had discovered something that could impact the entire world. It was no surprise that many people wanted this information, or even better, they wanted Isaac to come work for their country. The United States would have been happy to have him. Unlike other countries, we just ask him to work for us and respect Isaac's answer no matter what it was. Some hostile countries would snatch Isaac the first chance they got. They'd simply kidnap him and smuggle him into a hostile country. He'd never see his family again, and they never know what happened to him. The United States got wind of the fact that Isaac was being sent to present a paper at a conference. This was big news for two reasons. First, Isaac's native country was very protective of him, and he was not allowed to exit his country. The only reason he was being allowed out was because his native country was proud of his accomplishment. They wanted to make sure the world knew that a scientist from country X had made this discovery. Second, the conference was taking place in a friendly country. France was a place a U.S. intelligence officer could move around in with relative ease. My job was to make sure that Isaac was safe. That might sound strange since he wasn't an American. The U.S. government just knew how dangerous it could be if certain hostile nations had Isaac in their possession. Naturally, we'd be thrilled if he came to work for the United States, but my number one priority was keeping him out of harm's way. We couldn't let Isaac get into the wrong hands. They are targets and they're being watched. Here's another thing you need to know about national assets. Sometimes they lose their freedom. This is true to varying degrees for such geniuses all over the world. The truth is, their minds are so valuable that they're going to be watched just in case they are compromised. Is this person traveling anywhere strange? Are they traveling more frequently than usual? And by the way, in some countries, national assets aren't allowed to leave their native country at all, while others may just be prohibited from traveling to certain places. A national asset's finances are also monitored, since a large influx of cash is a red flag that something is up. Relationships are everything. Oscar continues, I only had a few days to work, so in addition to securing Isaac's safety, I had to try to develop a rapport with him very quickly. I went to the conference and listened to his lecture, barely understanding a word. At lunchtime, I noticed that several other men seemed to be intensely watching Isaac. I was able to get confirmation from my colleagues that these guys were in fact from a very hostile country and they were going to snatch Isaac the very second they could. It was tempting to approach Isaac and alert him to the situation, but that could cause a big problem. If the other spies saw me talking to Isaac, I would be burning myself. It would be obvious that I was an intelligence officer, and I didn't want that to happen. I had to find another way to keep Isaac away from these seriously bad guys. I had to act quickly, and that's when I had an idea. I saw Ezra standing in the corner of the room. He was one of the people running the conference, and we had enjoyed a nice conversation when I arrived that morning. I made sure to be very warm and friendly, and I let him know how excited I was to be in his country. Breaking a rule to save a life. I called Ezra over and told him I needed to speak to him immediately in private. Ezra could sense that I was worried. I told him we were going to have a frank discussion and I needed him to trust me. That's when I broke the rules and admitted I was at the conference on behalf of the U.S. government. I told them that certain individuals were planning to kidnap Isaac and it would be a disaster if that happened. The world would be in danger. It would also look terrible for the host country, and lastly, an innocent man would be pulled away from his family. I knew that if these guys were planning to kidnap Isaac, it meant they had their vehicles parked nearby. I had one of my colleagues figure out where the cars were parked, and sure enough, they were right outside. I told Ezra that I needed him to find a way to get the cars towed immediately. Ezra was a little confused and surprised, but said he'd do it. Only a few minutes passed, and there was an announcement that certain cars were about to be towed. Sure enough, the guys who I suspected worked for Country X went running out of the building. I remember almost laughing to myself because these guys were actually wearing trench coats. It was like something right out of a spy novel. Think like a spy. Make relationships everywhere you go. The idea that spies are always slipping in and out of shadows, never being seen by anyone, is totally wrong. While there are obviously moments when a spy doesn't want to be seen, much of the time a spy knows that making relationships everywhere is crucial to his or her success or even survival. Spies will chat up bellhops, taxi drivers, waiters, maids, anyone who might prove helpful if something happens. All of the people you meet going about your everyday life or while traveling hold different bits of information. You never know when that information might be useful to you, or even when it might save your life. A risky move. Oscar continues. I finally met Isaac, and I did my best to convince him to work for the U.S. government. Bottom line, he wasn't interested. But that didn't mean I wasn't going to try to get a copy of what Isaac discovered. I knew where Isaac was staying, and I went over to his hotel while other presentations were being given. I walked through the lobby like I owned the place, and no one questioned me. I went up to the fourth floor and located his room. It was locked, of course, but luckily I saw a maid down the hall. I was determined to get into that room, so I put a big smile on my face and explained to the maid that I really needed to use the bathroom, desperately, but I had forgotten my key and could she help? I even started to squirm like a little kid. She believed me and let me right into Isaac's room. Isaac had made no attempt to hide his items. Right there on a table was a pile of floppy disks, and they were clearly labeled with the name of his presentation. I pocketed them, hoping there would be more valuable information on the disks. I couldn't steal them, though. After the near-kidnapping attempt, I knew Isaac would be on high alert and would report to the police that the disks were missing. I had to get these disks copied and back into his room quickly. He'd never know they were missing. Keep in mind that this was years before personal computers were common, so I had to find a way to get these copied quickly. Think like a spy. Act like you own the place. I'm not suggesting that you do anything illegal like trespassing. However, there are times when you might need access to a restricted area. Maybe you're trying to get away from someone who you think is following you, or maybe there's an emergency taking place and it's the only safe place for you to be. The secret to accessing restricted areas is simple. Just act like you're supposed to be there. Don't glance around the area looking to see who's paying attention. Just behave normally and chances are no one will question you. Oscar continues. Ezra had really impressed me by figuring out how to get the bad guy's cars towed so quickly. He just jumped right on it and made it happen. I implored him again. I reminded him that my presence helped thwart a major kidnapping at his conference, and I needed him to help me one more time. He was reluctant, of course, but he did it. He copied the discs for me. I immediately got a copy to the necessary personnel and then did the more complicated work of breaking back into Isaac's hotel room to put his discs back. I wiped up all my fingerprints and made sure there was no sign I was ever there. A new spy is born. The last part of my operation involved a meeting with intelligence in my host country. The discs were analyzed, and we realized Isaac had his paper, as well as his classified government work, on the same discs. This was intelligence of major significance. Not only was there information about Formula X, Isaac's creation, but we now had Country X's entire encryption system. It was a huge coup. I knew that this wouldn't have happened without Ezra. His quick thinking and willingness to help out America was key. I was sure to explain this to the intelligence officers in Ezra's country. I was satisfied that I'd fulfilled my requirement. Isaac was safe, we had gained major intelligence, and I was still in one piece. Later on, I was very proud to receive some major awards for this operation. It always feels good to be recognized for your work. But it was nothing compared to a surprise I got a few months down the line. I was busy on another operation in another country when, much to my surprise, I ran into Ezra. It turned out his country was so impressed with his skills that they trained him to be an intelligence officer. Knowing that another spy was born and that I had something to do with it was one of the proudest moments of my career. Your inner spy. Spies are constantly faced with situations where they have to make split-second decisions. A colleague of mine describes it as like being in the middle of a car wreck. The car is spinning. What do you do? Do you steer or apply the brakes? You have a moment to decide before your car crashes right into the huge semi that's up ahead. In the story you've just heard, Oscar is faced with a major decision. Break the rules and tell Ezra that he needs his help and that he's actually working for the U.S. government, or risk a couple of goons snatching Isaac on Oscar's watch. Which is worse? Spies are constantly assessing situations and asking, what can I do? What are the possibilities? What is the right decision to make with the information I have right now? Tactic number one, assess your options, the OODA loop. To help assess situations and enable the best possible decision-making, guys like Oscar use something called the OODA loop. The OODA loop was created by a former Air Force captain named John Boyd to help pilots make decisions during air combat. However, the OODA loop can help you clarify the decision-making process in many different situations, from how to react in an emergency to making important business decisions. The OODA loop is a four-part decision process that helps intelligence officers make the best decisions possible and very quickly. The four parts are observe, orient, decide, and act. Part 1. Observe. In Part 1, you need to assess the information you currently have and look at information from as many sources as possible. The more information you have available to you, the better the perception you have. Ask yourself the following questions to ensure you're picking up all of the information available to you. Are there circumstances unfolding that I need to know about? What is happening right now? What direct impact does it have on me? Is anything happening that can affect me indirectly? Is there anything happening that might impact things for me at a later time? Have I made accurate predictions about what's happening? Is there a big difference between prediction and the reality of what's happening? Part 2, Orient.